I was recently reading some email, and the person who had written was a little disillusioned. They, like me, had always believed simply what the Bible said when it came to the origin of the universe, the origin of life. There in the first two chapters of the book of Genesis, it all seems rather plain, rather simple. 6 days, God made everything out of nothing. 6 days, God made everything out of nothing. And I, in a kind of a childlike way, had always reasoned that if God is God, that's not a problem for God. 6 days is not a problem for God. Could have been 6 minutes if he wanted to speed things up, but 6 days is not a problem for an all-powerful God. Out of nothing? Not a problem for God. Nowadays, that simple view, some people would say too childlike a view of the origin of the universe and of life, is not a popular teaching. That simple view, 6 days, God made everything out of nothing. It's not popular in the world, of course. It's not popular in the classroom. It's not even very popular among Christians. Why is it important that Christians still believe this? Why is it important that we know a little something about creation and evolution in order to continue the debate between these two great views of where everything and everyone came from? We're going to talk with Ron Rhodes about the creation-evolution debate during this hour of Issues Etc. Feel free to join us. Our call-in number, 1-800-730-2727, 1-800-730-2727. Dr. Ron Rhodes is a regular guest here on Issues Etc. He's president of Reasoning from the Scriptures Ministries and author of numerous books, including his latest called 10 Things You Should Know About the Creation versus Evolution Debate. Ron, welcome back.
Well, thank you. It's always good to be with you.
Ron, why does it matter when this seems to be a very unpopular teaching that if Christians wanted to get along a little better in the classroom, in the world in general, even with other Christians, they'd do well just to kind of forget this whole 6 days God made everything out of nothing?
Well, personally, I think it matters a great deal. After all, it does affect how we look at ourselves and how we look at other people. Obviously, if we're all just a bunch of cosmic accidents, then that's one thing. But if indeed we are created in the image of God, that's entirely different. You see, I see myself as somebody created in God's image, and I'm accountable to him. Whereas if evolution is true, and I'm just an accident, then there's no God, there's no commandments to obey, and basically I can come up with my own morality. I can become a law unto myself. And Todd, that's not to mention, what do you do with Genesis and the Bible and Jesus Christ? Obviously, if evolution is true, then we've got to do something with the book of Genesis because it cannot be trusted. It must be mythological. It must be fiction if evolution is true. And the problem with that is that the New Testament cites the Genesis account about 60 times. So what do you do with the New Testament? And indeed, what do you do with Jesus Christ, who himself in Matthew 19 and elsewhere said that he accepted the creation account of Adam and Eve? And so I think that you can see that there are some pretty powerful implications regarding this debate. Is evolution true or is creationism true?
Well, you mentioned, what do you do with Jesus Christ? Can we push it a step further and say, what do you do with Jesus himself, not just his testimony regarding the origins of the universe and life, but with the man himself? Is he just like the rest of us, according to evolution, the product of random chance? Is he merely just another evolved human being, or is he, in fact, who Scripture portrays him to be, God come in human flesh, the second Adam, the real second Adam, the perfect man?
Well, that's a very good question, and I think that in answer to that, there are many evolutionists who would categorize themselves as atheists and humanists who would say that Jesus was just a man and nothing more. And they would say that we don't need a God to explain the universe, that naturalism explains everything, this idea that the laws of nature account for everything, including Jesus Christ. Conversely, though, consider the fact that if Jesus was who he claimed to be, if he truly was God in human flesh, then he cannot be wrong because he is omniscient. And if he cannot be wrong, then that means that you can trust the New Testament and you can trust the book of Genesis. And you can trust the fact of creation. And so I think the battle lines are very clear today. And it's not very easy to stand in a middle ground. Really, you've got to be on one side or the other. Now, I know that there are some who try to be in both camps, But that's quite a feat, and maybe we'll talk about that a little later.
Well, let's get to that right now before we get to the whole issue, because someone's going to say, look, I believe there's a halfway house between Genesis and Darwin. I think I can find a synthesis between the two. What's the problem, Ron?
Well, I think that both creationists and evolutionists would go after you on that. Certainly, Darwin said that if any part of his theory had to be explained in terms of a deity, then his entire theory collapses. I think that if Darwin heard you made that statement, he would probably not just turn over in his grave, but he would be in high spin within his grave. I think that creationists, too, have many problems with the idea that evolution could be true in any sense, even in the sense that God could guide the process of evolution. Of course, I'm talking about the theistic evolutionists who try to say that God was kind of like a force that guided the process of evolution throughout the ages. And so those days of Genesis are not literal days, but rather they are long spans of time through which God guided the process of evolution. And they would say that at some point God took an already existing creature, a higher primate, and modified it a little bit and put a soul within it and called it a man. Now, you just cannot get that from the book of Genesis, and so you end up where we started. If you argue that way, you've got to say that the book of Genesis is myth. You've got to say that the New Testament is wrong in verifying the book of Genesis. You've also got to say that Jesus was wrong in confirming the creation account of Adam and Eve, because obviously if Adam was just an ape with a soul put into it, then Jesus' words about the subject mean very little.
Tell us about the difference, and this is a crucial distinction that needs to be understood going into the debate between creation and evolution, the difference between microevolution and macroevolution.
I'm glad you asked that, because a lot of times evolutionists cite what they consider to be evidences for evolution, when in fact all they are really providing is evidences for microevolution. And let's define those categories. Microevolution refers to changes that occur within the same species. Macroevolution, by contrast, refers to a transition or an evolution of one species into another different species. So, for example, within the human species, you might have certain changes that take place over time. You know, they might become slightly taller over time, or their brain capacity might increase, or something minor. Or, you know, you might have different color eyes or hair. Microevolution accounts for minor changes within species. But macroevolution involves, say, for example, a bird turning into a horse or a cat turning into a dog. And very often, like I say, evolutionists cite evidences for microevolution and tend to say that that's a proof for the whole process of evolution, including macroevolution. And so I think that we need to be very careful here in our definitions. You know, Scripture in the book of Genesis says that God created the initial kinds of animals, and then reproduction took place generation by generation according to their kind. But you never find one kind evolving into another kind. And Todd, I know that you've done some study on DNA. I personally think that, human DNA remains human DNA, dog DNA remains dog DNA, cat DNA remains cat DNA, and within each species, that pool of DNA allows for a certain amount of change. But still, the DNA always remains, identical and intrinsic to the species. For example, within that pool of humanity, you might have DNA that allows for blue eyes or brown eyes, dark skin or light skin, dark hair or light hair, being tall or being short, being stocky or having a scrawny frame. The gene pool allows for all of that, but I'm never going to evolve into some other kind of creature because the DNA doesn't allow for it.
So when Scripture tells us that God created all of the living creatures to reproduce after their own kind, that does not preclude the fact that within their own kind, that is, within what we call species, there can be all sorts of variation and all sorts of change over time due to environmental factors and all sorts of other things.
Well, that's right. And, just consider the dog as an example. You've got little chihuahuas. You've got, these long dogs, these dachshunds. You've got German Shepherds, you've got Great Danes. I mean, these are dogs that have immensely different kinds of shapes. Some of them have deep growls, while others have very high and whiny growls. And so you've got a tremendous amount of variety within the gene pool of dogs, but dogs will always remain dogs because dog DNA will always remain dog DNA.
The bigger context, and I think many people fail to see this, the bigger context, bigger than even this all-encompassing theory called evolution, is a worldview called naturalism. Give us the basic tenets of the naturalist worldview.
Well, this is such an important issue that I've devoted an entire chapter to it in my book, because naturalism really does rule in the academic community today. I don't care what college you go to, what university you go to, what institution of higher learning you go to, naturalism reigns. It absolutely rules. And this is the idea that there is a natural explanation for everything. Nature is the whole show. There is no God who supernaturally intervenes to cause changes in our world. There's no such thing as miracles whereby God brings about changes. But rather, the laws of nature are the default explanation for anything. In fact, the way I put it in my book is that the great commandment of naturalism seems to be this: thou shalt assume that there is a natural explanation for everything in the universe, and the second commandment is much like it. Thou shalt not even ponder the possibility that anything or anyone outside the natural world, like God, has influenced the natural world, for this natural world is all there is. Do you remember that show Cosmos, put on by Carl Sagan some years ago?
I sure do.
You know, he started out by talking about how the cosmos is all there is or ever will be. That's naturalism, the idea that nature is the whole show. And this is such a predominant viewpoint that unless we as creationists can figure out ways to undermine this naturalistic philosophy, I don't think our arguments against evolution are going to go very far. So we've got to take this into consideration.
Well, one of the great weaknesses of naturalism, just in terms of its thought, that's been pointed out by you and other guests on this program, Ron, is that naturalism, while it claims to simply follow the empirical evidence to its logical conclusion, actually excludes anything that cannot be observed or measured in the way that kind of the science of the day says things ought to be able to be measured or observed.
You know, that's a good point. And I think that if you were going to exclude anything that you cannot measure, then you're going to have to exclude a whole lot of stuff that people have called scientific through the years. You know, there's a lot of people out there in the scientific community who claim to believe in the Big Bang, but nobody was there to actually see it happen. You know, nobody was actually there watching this thing allegedly unfold. And by the way, I say allegedly because it's by no means a proven fact. There are scientists for and against that theory. What about the Ice Age with the expansion of glaciers around the globe? You know, people write about that scientifically, but people were not around to watch it. There's one theory after another that I could point out scientifically where people were not there to actually witness this thing, but people still accept it as science. I mean, my goodness, you could even point to evolutionary theory and tell evolutionists that they were not there to see this alleged common ancestor between human beings and the ape community, but nevertheless, they say that it's scientific to believe in it. And so, really, what it all boils down to, Todd, is that evolutionism is a faith system. You know, I often hear evolutionists say that creationism is strictly about faith, that there's no facts. Well, evolutionism is a faith system. And the big question is, which of the two, which between evolution and creation has the evidence to support it? It's my belief, and it's the belief of even a lot of scientists today, that the evidence is not on the side of evolution.
My son, just last night, we were working on a little project he has. He's in second grade. He's doing a science project on a blue whale. Now, one of the books, and you can hardly avoid this in the books on biology, one of the books that he had a little paragraph written at the level of the second grader, of course, talking about how this greatest of all mammals resides now in the sea, but at one time it probably was a land-dwelling creature many hundreds of millions of years ago, and then migrated slowly but surely to make its way in the sea. Now, he read this at the level of the second grader, and was, I think, on the verge of just kind of taking that to be the truth. I mean,
well, that was the same with me when I was growing up.
Yeah, and I was quick to point out to him, again, at the level of the 8-year-old, that just because it says it in the book doesn't mean it's necessarily true. Yes, these whales are great seafaring mammals, but God made them to go in the sea precisely as they do today. Now, I guess this kind of, someone might raise the objection at this point and say, yeah, but doesn't the fossil record argue against that kind of simplistic view of the origin of these great creatures? What about the fossil record, Ron?
Well, the fossil record is something that was initially thought to be something that would solidly be on the side of evolutionary theory. And in fact, Darwin speculated that as time passed on, more and more fossils would be discovered that substantiated his viewpoint. But here's the problem with that viewpoint. If evolutionary theory were true, what you would expect to see is a steady progression from simple life forms to increasingly complex life forms. You know, at the lower strata of rocks, you would expect to see maybe some one-cell organisms, and then maybe a couple of strata up from that, you might start to see a little bit more complexity. And then generation by generation, as new strata of rock is laid down, you would see increasing complexity all the way up to human beings today. But you know what? That's not what we see in the fossil evidence. In fact, one of the things that scientists have noticed about the fossil evidence is what they call stasis, the absence of change. In fact, all of a sudden, during the Cambrian age, there's this sudden explosion of animal life forms that were fully formed. You didn't have partial creatures with little stubs on the side of the body that would one day become wings. You didn't have creatures with little stubs where the legs should be that would one day become legs, but rather you had virtually hundreds and thousands of fully formed animal creatures suddenly appear. And that led one popular evolutionist to say that it almost looks like these life forms were just planted there. Well, of course, we as creationists believe that they were planted by the Creator himself. And so, all of that, along with the fact that there's no true transitional forms between different species in the fossil record, leads me to believe that the fossils actually support creationism and not evolution.
We're talking with Dr. Ron Rhodes, president of Reasoning from the Scriptures Ministries, about the creation-evolution debate. We're pointing out some important things we need to know about what's, the status of the debate. That's the first thing you do when you sit down to debate. You say, what's really at issue here? And we're laying some of these things out in a simple fashion with Dr. Ron Rhodes during this hour of Issues, Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Our call-in number, 1-800-730-2727. 1-800-730-2727. We also have that live in-studio email address, issuesetc@kfuo.org. issuesetc@kfuo.org. Well, if not then the fossil record, Ron, what about people's, they look at the anatomy of the New World ape, they look at the anatomy of the modern human being and some human beings who have preceded us in time, Neanderthal, others, and they say, look, you compare the anatomy, the differences are so slight, it's just a little jump from a New World ape or something like it, to a less evolved form of human being. Does comparative anatomy do anything to bolster evolution's claims?
Well, evolutionists think so, but I don't think it's a strong argument at all. The fact is that we were all made by the same Creator, and it makes sense that the Creator would consider the environment that He intended to place us in and design our bodies accordingly. We were put into an environment where we're going to need noses to smell, eyes to see, ears to hear, and so forth. And the fact is that eyes work. They work. The design that the Creator worked into all animals is a design that works. You know, in my book, I point out how we can often look at some of the paintings of the great painters, and even though they're paintings of different things, they're nevertheless such that they have similarities which give away who the painter was. You know, even a modern painter like Thomas Kincaid is someone whose paintings we can look at, and we can automatically know who painted it just because of the similarities between all of his paintings. I point out in the book how even modern human engineers do much the same thing in terms of building different objects. For example, wheels work great in cars and buses and tractors and wagons and bicycles. Light bulbs, they work great in houses and buildings, cars, outdoor stadiums and street lamps. Air conditioners work fabulously in cars and houses and buildings. You know, I can go on and on, but I think you see my point. Eyes work. Ears work. Having arms with hands that can grasp objects works. And so the divine creator gave his animal kingdom and humans a similar design, but that doesn't prove that one species grew out of another species. That's an unwarranted leap in logic.
What about the person who says, okay, if the divine creator did equip us for the world we were to live in, he would put us in with all these things that work. What about the things that don't appear to have a function, or at least a function anymore, so-called vestigial organs?
Well, you know, I've read a lot about that in a lot of textbooks put out by the evolutionists, and it's very interesting that even though your mainstream evolutionists are no longer using this argument, the argument nevertheless continues to appear in college university textbooks. Now, at one time, there was about 180 organs in the body that were considered vestigial or having no purpose. They were thought to have a purpose at one time in our evolution, but long ago, they became useless. And at one time, the thyroid gland and the thymus, the pineal gland, the tonsils, the ear muscles, the appendix, these and many more organs were considered useful at one time, but no longer useful. Today, as a result of scientific study, that list has now dwindled to between 0 and 6, depending upon who you talk to. And the fact is, Todd, is that there has been discoveries regarding specific uses of these various glands. For example, it's been found that the thyroid gland actually secretes hormones related to proper metabolism. The appendix is part of the immune system that contains antibodies, and it apparently plays a significant role for young children, more so than adults. Same thing with the thymus. It was once categorized as useless, but now it's been found to relate to the body's immune system. So my point to you is that all these organs that were thought to be useless, you know, today, but formerly used to be, you know, good working organs for the body, this argument is no longer taken seriously by some of the mainstream evolutionists out there. And it's time that the textbooks recognize this. You know, sometimes these textbooks are not very careful, but they continue to repeat the same old stuff, you know, one textbook after another, just copying the same old stuff. It's time for the scientists to take that one out of the textbooks.
Ron Rhodes is our guest president of Reasoning from the Scriptures. Folks, if you'd like to contact the website for Reasoning from the Scriptures, go first to our website, issuesetc.org, issuesetc.org. Click on the links with regular guests. You scroll down there, you'll find Ron Rhodes and Reasoning from the Scriptures Ministries. Issuesetc.org is our website address. Now, when we come back from this break, we'll continue our conversation, 25 more minutes, with Dr. Ron Rhodes, author of numerous books, including his latest called 10 Things You Should Know About the Creation versus Evolution Debate. We'll be talking about mutation. Now, according to the evolutionist, what's taking place on the ground all throughout the long course of evolution is genetic mutation. Okay? Does genetic mutation produce a more evolved creature? Does genetic mutation allow for the crossing of species boundaries? In other words, can a cat mutate over a long period of time through many generations into a dog or any other species for that matter? Can an ape, through mutation, cross the boundary of what we think of as the ape species into the human species? Ron Rhodes will answer that question and several other important issues, including the whole issue of intelligent design, when we come back from this break.
Equipping the priesthood of all believers. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
The teaching of the entire Scripture is made up of two doctrines, the law and the gospel. With the proper distinction between law and gospel, one correctly understands God's Word. Without that distinction, Scripture remains a sealed book. Discover the proper distinction between law and gospel in our Issues Etc. Book of the Month for February, God's No and God's Yes. If you'd like to order the book, God's No and God's Yes, call Concordia Publishing House, 1-800-325-3040. Call weekdays during regular business hours, 1-800-325-3040. Or order online at our website, issuesetc.org. Click on the What's New section. You'll find information on God's No and God's Yes and a way to order the book, 1-800-325-3040. Or issuesetc.org.
A new rule by the Bush administration recently went into effect, a rule that recognizes and assists unborn children.
This is a special commentary from the Susan B. Anthony List, named for the suffragette who was proudly pro-life.
The Children's Health Insurance Program, also called CHIPS, provides health care for children from low-income households, including unborn children. By providing this prenatal care, the government recognizes the unborn child and gives low-income women a better choice. Although radical abortion supporters fought against the measure, this is as pro-woman and pro-child as it gets, and the Bush administration is to be applauded.
The Susan B. Anthony List is dedicated to supporting pro-life legislation, training candidates and activists, and promoting pro-life leaders. To view all this month's commentaries, visit our website at sba-list.org. That's sba-list.org.
In 1 Timothy chapter 5, Paul says to Timothy, "The sins of some men are obvious, reaching the place of judgment ahead of them. The sins of others trail behind them." What could that possibly mean? We'll talk about it with Pastor Mark Hawkinson of Bethlehem Lutheran Church in New Haven next time on The Bible Study. Heard weekday mornings at 10:05.
The Bible Study on AM 850 KFUO is underwritten by Concordia Christian Books and Gifts, serving God's people.
If I don't feel better after a worship service, what's the real problem? Pastor Sean Rippey answered that question on Issues Etc.
Those are issues of emotion. In essence, they go up, they go down. There's going to be good times, there's going to be bad times. But that's not where our faith lies, and that's not where worship should lie. Worship should lie in the objective reality of who Christ is, that whether I'm having a good day or a bad day, whether I enjoyed the service or not, I'm still forgiven. God still loves me. He's still there for me. Instead of walking out going, "I feel bad now after I came out of the worship service, therefore I didn't get the Spirit, therefore I didn't get forgiveness, therefore God doesn't love me." No. That's the problem with focusing on emotion.
Because it really isn't about you, it's about Jesus. We're Issues Etc. weekdays 3 to 6 here on AM 850 KFUO.
Issues Etc. is partially underwritten by Concordia Publishing House, publishers of our Book of the Month for February, God's No and God's Yes, the proper distinction between law and gospel. The cost is $9.99 plus shipping and handling. For more information, check out our website, issuesetc.org, or call Concordia Publishing House, 1-800-325-3040. God's No and God's Yes, our Issues Etc. Book of the Month for February.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Dr. Ron Rhodes is our guest. We're talking about the creation-evolution debate. This is but one part of what we consider here at Issues Etc., one of our driving forces, that is equipping the priesthood of all believers. We are attempting to, and I think doing a fairly good job, of laying out during this hour some basic ideas that the Christian needs to understand if he is going to engage in a formal or informal way the ideas of evolution, well-equipped not only with what the Bible teaches about creation and really does teach about creation, but also equipped with the ideas that evolution puts forward. We're trying to equip the priesthood of all believers. The importance of an educated laity cannot be overestimated. Now, we're only able to equip the priesthood of all believers with your financial support of Issues Etc. We are listener-supported. Now, I would like you to prayerfully consider joining our new monthly donor program. It's called the Issues Etc. Reformation Club. We have three different levels of giving: the confessor, the apologist, and the reformer. Here's what you get for joining Issues Etc., our Reformation Club. At the level of the confessor, for $25 a month or an annual gift of $250, you'll get an Issues Etc. journal subscription, an Issues Etc. tape of the month, and a book by Craig Parton called The Defense Never Rests. As a token of our thanks, at the level of the apologist, $50 a month or an annual gift of $500, you'll get all the benefits of being a confessor, plus a quarterly Issues Etc. book of the month. That's four books throughout the course of the year. And then at the level of the reformer, for $100 a month or an annual gift of $1,000, you'll have all the benefits of the confessor and the apologist. You'll get three Issues Etc. journal subscriptions, one to keep, two to give away. You'll get two Issues Etc. tapes of the month, one to keep, one to give away, a written transcript of each Issues Etc. tape of the month, and an Issues Etc. book of the month for all 12 months of the year. You can join our Reformation Club by donating online. Our website, issuesetc.org. You can make a credit card donation as well by calling our resource line, 1-800-737-0172, 1-800-737-0172, or you can join the Reformation Club, become a confessor, an apologist, or a reformer by check. Just write us at Issues Etc., Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri, 63117. Ron, back to our discussion of the creation versus evolution debate. It has been put, and you have this early in one of the chapters of your book, it's been put by one theologian that evolution is mutations, or I guess I should say positive mutations, plus natural selection, whatever that is. I'd like you to explain that to me. Plus enough time, and you'll have evolution. Now, let's deal with each one of those in turn. The whole idea that a mutation can produce a fitter creature rather than a less fit creature.
Well, that's a foundational point that we need to make, because a mutation always involves a change in the DNA sequence within a gene. Every one of us have DNA, and there's a lot of information packed into that DNA. In fact, you could take the Encyclopedia Britannica, actually you could get four or five copies of the entire Encyclopedia Britannica, and all that information would not equal a single strand of DNA. So this DNA is something that's really responsible for, you know, our design, for the way that we look and so forth. But a mutation involves a copying error. Typically in a mutation, information is lost because there's a copying error. This means, for example, pretty severe mutation might be a human being born without a arm or without a limb. That's a bad mutation because there was a copying error in the DNA. Or if I might use an analogy, let's say like I have the copying plans for a motorcycle. A negative mutation would be such that the motorcycle came out looking like maybe the seat was attached to the front wheel and the handlebars attached underneath the back wheel, if you can picture that in your brain. That would never work, that kind of design. But that's the kind of thing that we're talking about. When there's a copying error in the DNA, something bad typically happens. And here's the thing I want to emphasize, Todd. 99.9% of all mutations are negative. 99.9%. Very seldomly do you have a positive mutation. But you never have a mutation such that a new species comes into being. Do you know what would have to happen in order for a new species to emerge? You'd have to have new information being introduced into that DNA. It's kind of like my computer word processor program writing a spreadsheet by itself. It's like information writing new information. It just doesn't happen, Todd.
Doesn't that violate even the basic premise and worldview, the naturalist worldview of the evolutionist, to say that, they seem to operate on the assumption that the universe is a closed system, and in a closed system, new information can't be added?
Well, it would seem to contradict, you know, what they're saying, but their explanation is time. As long as you can introduce enough time to the equation, then that's going to allow for all these evolutionistic possibilities to occur. It's like that old story about the monkeys typing, you know, and if you give them enough time, they might type something, Shakespearean. But I can tell you that no amount of time is going to allow the introduction of this new information into the DNA, which would allow for one species becoming a different species. That's never been observed scientifically, and there's no possibility of it happening. Now, Todd, earlier you mentioned natural selection. That relates to what we're talking about. So can I define that very briefly?
Yeah, would you? Because sometimes when you hear evolutionists talk about natural selection, it's almost personified as though it's an intelligent driving force behind the whole system.
Well, that's right. And basically what evolutionists would say is that every species typically produces far more members than can possibly be supported by the environment. So what happens is this. There's a struggle for survival. Each member of the species vies for the limited resources in the environment, and this struggle is going to have winners and losers. Now, can you guess who the winners will be? The winners will be those of that species who have superior traits, and the losers are those who typically have inferior traits. So what we're talking about is the survival of the fittest. Those with inferior traits will die off, whereas those with superior traits will pass on their superior traits to their offspring, and then their offspring, in this whatever environment they're living in, will continue to develop even more positive traits, which they themselves will then pass on to their offspring. And as this process goes on, generation by generation, evolution takes place. So this whole process of natural selection is at the very heart of evolutionary theory. You know, one example they sometimes give is the polar bear, that, you know, the polar bears found themselves in a cold environment, and so some of these polar bears developed the characteristic of a thicker coat of hair, and this superior trait was passed on to certain polar bears, whereas the other inferior polar bears who had thin coats ended up passing away. And so that's cited as an example of natural selection in action. But what do you notice here, Todd, about the polar bear? Does the polar bear become another species? No, this is what you call microevolution. This gets back to what I was talking about earlier in the broadcast. It is within the gene pool of polar bears to develop thicker hair. And that's perfectly compatible with what a creationist believes. But you don't see the polar bear becoming a human being or some other kind of a creature. That would be macroevolution, and there's no evidence to support it.
Or, for that matter, turning into something even more suited to the Arctic environment, maybe something that dwells in the relatively warmer environment of the ocean water. Why not just evolve into a seal or something like that?
Well, exactly. You know, and for that to happen, the DNA would actually have to change. There would have to be the introduction of new DNA into that creature that would make it possible for that creature not only to live underwater, like a seal, or above water, but also to live in the environment of an even colder environment, because water is actually colder than the air in many instances. But again, this introduction of new information into the DNA is not something that's ever been scientifically observed, and in fact, it's impossible because, you know, seal DNA remains seal DNA, polar bear DNA remains polar bear DNA, human DNA remains human DNA.
Ron, you mentioned time in there in this equation. Before we go on to talk about intelligent design and take a phone call or two here, is there enough time? Is there enough time, given the most current thinking among evolutionists in this universe, to account for what they say must be accounted for according to their model?
Well, that's a good question. I think that most evolutionists would say that there is sufficient time. And, of course, they would date the Earth very old. You know, they would talk about how the Big Bang happened between 12 and 15 billion years ago, and then galaxies started to form, you know, several billion years after that. And they'd talk about how life on planet Earth began many millions of years ago, and perhaps maybe around 12 million years ago, what would become man came about on Earth. And so this process has allegedly been going on for a very, very long time. But Todd, what I'm really wanting to emphasize to you is that no matter how much time you work into the equation, it does not change the scientific fact that no new information gets introduced into the DNA. And furthermore, the fossil record simply doesn't support it. if what you said was true, you know, with a man evolving from lower creatures, you'd expect to see transitional forms. You would expect to see simple life forms evolving into complex life forms. But what we see in the fossil record is stasis, with entire creatures fully formed, and the great majority of them being fully formed at the same time during the Cambrian Age. So again, the evidence, I believe, is on the side of the creationist.
Let's go to the phones. Folks, if you have a question or a comment on the creation-evolution debate, give us a call, 1-800-730-2727. The best caller will receive Ron Rhodes' new book called The 10 Things You Should Know About Creation Versus Evolution Debate, 1-800-730-2727. Up first, Jim is calling from his car. Jim, welcome to Issues Etc.
Thank you, Todd. Dr. Rhodes, I agree with everything that you're saying. I would question, or would you address this question for me? Is it possible for a believer to hold to creationism and yet still believe in an old universe? I don't know if you're familiar with books by, like Hugh Ross, Creator in the Cosmos, or Jack Collins, Science and Faith, but the idea that we have a universe that's 12 to 15 billion years old, as you just spoke of,
yes.
Can they coincide? I'd be interested in what you think of that.
Thank you very much, Jim. Ron?
Well, that's a good question. In fact, I've asked some of the greatest thinkers of our land what their opinion is on the matter. And, for example, I asked Dr. Norman Geisler his opinion on this, and he told me that 4 days a week he's an old Earth creationist and 3 days a week he's a young Earth creationist. I was reading J.P. Moreland, who was a great philosopher at Biola University, and he says that even though he's an old Earth creationist, he strongly suspects that the young Earthers are correct. So there is this discussion going on between young Earthers and old Earthers, and what I've done in my book is that I have tried to fairly represent both the old Earth and the young Earth position, presenting the best evidences for those positions, and I've also, to be fair, presented the criticisms against those positions. And, of course, the book is titled The 10 Things You Need to Know About the Creation-Evolution Debate. I wouldn't be doing my job unless I alerted people, you know, Christians, to the fact that in our own camp, in our own family, there are differences of opinion between how this should be interpreted. Now, even though I personally don't agree with the old Earth position, there are those, like Hugh Ross and others, who argue that perhaps the days of Genesis were literal days that were separated by long periods of time. Others would argue that the days themselves were long ages. And hence, even though God himself was the creator and he engaged in a series of creative acts over this long period of time, nevertheless, the Genesis account is not to be taken literally in terms of the days that are mentioned. Now, my personal problem with that interpretation of days is that morning and night are mentioned. You've got the mention of light and darkness. You've also got the fact that whenever a number is used with the Hebrew word for day, which is the Hebrew word yom, it always means a literal solar day, and there's no exceptions to that in the Hebrew Old Testament. And so those would be the arguments that would be argued against that position. And so, like I said, yes, within the family of God, both positions are possible, but I lean towards a more literal take on the book of Genesis personally.
By the way, folks, I have given this some considerable thought, and we have a little piece I've written up on our website, issuesetc.org, titled Seven Questions for Old Earth Creationists, and basically driving the same direction that Ron is driving, really asking the old Earth creationists, from the text of Genesis itself, not from outside information, but from the text of Genesis itself, show me how it's something other than a literal consecutive 6 days. It's a very difficult case for the old Earth creationist to make. The website address, issuesetc.org. We got a great search engine, Jared. Just put in old Earth creationist and you'll find that brief article. Let's go back to the phones, 1-800-730-2727, 1-800-730-2727. Andy's on the line. Andy, welcome.
Hi. They always say that evolution is the foundation of modern biology, which I would tend to say no, genetics is the foundation of modern biology, and it was discovered by a Roman Catholic priest. I'll hang up and listen.
Thank you, Andy. What about this objection that if we toss out evolution, we are of necessity tossing out all of modern biology.
Well, I don't think that that's true. I think that, first of all, let's recognize that there are paradigm shifts within the scientific community. And if anybody doubts that, they just have to consult Thomas Kuhn's book, The Structure of Scientific Revolutions. When I'm talking about a paradigm shift, I'm talking about a scientific understanding of reality. Scientists are constantly coming up with new data, and they're dispelling old paradigms and coming up with new paradigms to understand reality. Now, creationists are big believers in biology. They believe that there is uniformity in the world of nature. They also believe that God can intervene in the world of nature whenever he deems necessary. But because there is uniformity in the world of nature, then it is possible to do science by replication and by studying results and by repeating those results and so forth. So I don't believe that simply believing in creationism in any way affects the scientific methodology, not just of biology, but of all the other sciences out there. Certainly some of the greatest scientists that have existed on this planet have come from a Christian worldview and a creationist worldview at that. And to me, that's rather telling, don't you think?
I think so, too. Larry's calling from his car. Hi, Larry.
Hi. I just wanted to comment that I am increasingly impressed by the number of people who are not Christians, but are accomplished scientists who are abandoning the evolutionary faith because of the scientific evidence. I think of people like Richard Milton shattering the Darwinian myth, and the chemical biologist Behe, and so on.
Yes.
And I think there are an increasing number of these, are there not?
Well, you're right. In fact, I do talk about it in that book. In fact, there's one astronomer by the name of Frederick Hoyle who's come to the conclusion that a super intellect has monkeyed with physics as well as with chemistry and biology. I think about astronomer George Greenstein, who after observing the apparent design in the universe, and he wasn't coming from a Christian worldview, but he nevertheless asked if it is possible that we have stumbled upon scientific proof for the existence of a supreme being. And for many people, I think that this intelligent design has become a beginning point of faith. Robert Jastrow, who wrote God and the Astronomers, said that if the universe had not been made with the most exacting precision, we could never have come into existence. You know, everywhere you look in the universe, you see footprints and fingerprints of God. And I find it highly revealing that it's many scientists today who are saying that who don't have a bias towards Christianity.
Very briefly, in the time that's left to us, what is intelligent design? It is not a strict six-day creationist view, but it does seek to respond to evolution and to that prevailing view. What is it?
Well, that's right. I mean, if you look up in the sky and you see the words "free concert in the park tonight," you're probably not going to think that that's a weird-looking cloud. If you're driving in South Dakota and you come across four faces carved into the side of a mountain, you're probably not going to think that's due to rain erosion, but rather you see intelligent design there. Well, in the same way, intelligent design theorists are using scientific methodology similar to the methodology that crime scene investigators use today to discover evidence for intentionality. This is not only the case in terms of the universe around us, in terms of how the universe is fine-tuned for life, but even at the molecular level, scientists have discovered complex machines that must have been designed. There's no way that evolution can account for it. And if you might just use this analogy, if you consider a neighborhood with a garage door opening, and then a car driving out of the garage door with supplies to another house where the garage door opens, and then those supplies go into the new house where those supplies are then distributed to various people, well, you see something very similar at the molecular level. Mechanisms and complex machines that have such complexity that there's no way that you could explain it as a sheer accident. Same thing is true of things like the human eye or the wing of a bird. These things are so complex that intelligent design is obvious in them. And I've actually devoted two chapters to this in my book, one in which I talk about what intelligent design is, but most important, I talk about the objections that evolutionists have against intelligent design. And the reason I include that is that these evolutionists are nervous. They're nervous about what the intelligent design theorists are coming up with. and they're trying to throw anything against it that they can. And that's one of the reasons I include it in the book.
What's at stake here ultimately? We both approach this, of course, as Christians who come to this debate, not just as a matter of who's right in the origins of life and the universe, but ultimately what is at stake in this debate?
Well, I think in terms of the intelligent design, what's at stake is whether or not this naturalistic anti-God philosophy will continue to reign supreme in our culture. In my opinion, this evidence for intelligent design is just the thing that's going to poke a big hole in the boat of naturalism. And the thing of it is that naturalism plays a gives a very high role to science. So the question is, what if the science that naturalism holds in high regard starts to argue against naturalism itself? You see, that's what we see happening. So what's at stake is the philosophical foundation of our entire society. Will naturalism continue to rule, or will creationism, with the idea that there is intelligent design and a God who intervenes, will that become the reigning paradigm? It'll be interesting to watch the next 10 years.
Dr. Ron Rhodes, thank you so much for being our guest on Issues Etc.
My pleasure.
Dr. Ron Rhodes is president of Reasoning from the Scriptures Ministries. He is author of numerous books, including his latest, The 10 Things You Should Know About the Creation versus Evolution Debate. Now, you can check out Ron's website by going first to our website, issuesetc.org, issuesetc.org. There's a section there titled Links with Regular Guests. Click on that, and you'll find a direct link to Ron Rhodes and Reasoning from the Scriptures Ministries. Well, in addition to the foundation of, well, our worldview and our society, that is certainly at stake. We could also add one other thing. What's at stake in the first two chapters of Genesis? It answers a very simple question. Who are we? You see, if we are nothing but the product of blind chance over time, of matter coming together in coherent forms, replicating itself and continuing to replicate itself in newer and better forms, if that's all we are, the answer to that question, where does it lead us, ultimately? Not only to a godless universe, but a universe that is, in essence, blind and without direction. We are nothing more than chance ourselves. Really, in a godless universe becomes a hopeless universe. If we are, on the other hand, what Genesis 1 and 2 tell us that we are, the creatures of God, created in His image, having lost that image and in desperate need of His further intervention in the universe in a very particular way, namely, that He becomes man Himself in the person of Jesus Christ and pays the price for our sins and our fall in His body on the cross, that He has redeemed us from the curse of the fall, that He has brought us back into a reconciled relationship with God, that He will one day recreate all things again as good and as perfect. That's not a hopeless universe. If that's who we are, redeemed by Jesus Christ, that's a hopeful universe. That's a universe with not only a God, but also a Savior. I'm Todd Wilkin. This is Issues Etc.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for Issues Etc. to continue. Our address is Post Office Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri 63117. Or you can contact us via our website at www.issuesetc.org. That's www.issuesetc.org. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of this station or the Jubilee Network. Issues Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.